The Bible is a record of inspired, and I'll come back on that word later, but necessarily limited human insights into the mystery of God. Insights that real people, Jeremiah, Isaiah, they're real people, they've expressed to other real people of their own day in limited human words, Hebrew words, therefore limited, whatever language, and in specific cultural and historical situations. It's a tight sentence, but it's got a lot in it that every bit of it's very important. Why do we believe it's inspired? Because for centuries people have found it inspiring. It connects them with God when they listen. But some of you may have grown up, I partly grew up, almost thinking the Bible was dictated by God, so that it's all God's words, you know, and therefore you can't do anything with it. It's all there. It's absolute truth contained in this little book. Think about it for a minute. If God's going to inspire you or me or anybody, he's got to inspire a real person. A real person who's... they're nearly all male, so it's... how limited can you get? I mean, there's going to be a lot of insights that they can't get, that I can't. I'm only a bloke. They're only blokes. So give them a go, okay. But they are in prayer and they are listening, and more importantly, the community to whom they spoke, who often rejected them at the time, later on reflection, thought, boy, I wish I had have listened. I wish we had have listened. He was saying something significant to us and we didn't bother doing anything about it, etc. So on reflection, a community accepted it, wanted to read it again. Here you are, 2,500 years, 800 years later, coming along and interested in it yourself, it's still. So there's something going on here, but the insights, if God's going to choose anybody to inspire, he has to inspire a real human being. There aren't any others. So look for the words, realise it's a certain language, realise that that person was speaking, as we'll see next week and from then on, in a particular situation, so we better get to know the situation, what was happening at the time, and because that's clearly relevant, and what the results were, etc., etc. There's beauty and truth in the Bible texts, obviously. But to find their beauty, the beauty of the text and the truth in the text, as distinct from imposing on the text our own preconceived notions. You see the difference, don't you? It's so easy, and we still do it, people still do it, I guess I do it too without realising it, but if you see me do it, correct me. We have a certain point of view and we look to support it from the scriptures. And we find a text that fits it. So we use the text to support our idea. Apartheid has always done that. Vatican bureaucracy has always done that. Priests have always done it. Do you know what I mean? Mums have done it. Dads have done it. Haven't you? You tend to whatever it is, and it's not all bad will, it's just an easy thing to do. Excuse me. So in studying these texts, my aim at any case, I'm going to fail, but I'm going to do my best, is to look at the situation in which they are and try and find out what was Amos saying. Not what I like him to have said, but what was he saying? What was Jeremiah saying? And so we've got to know the language, we've got to know how the words were used at that time. You following me? You got to know what the syntax is of the sentences and how it was understood by... oh, you're lovely. Thanks, Mary. So if we're going to do that and find what's in the text rather than what we'd like to put there or what we see through coloured glasses, we need to explore the historically conditioned and necessarily limited human experiences that gave rise to the insights. Our aim in this course with you is to discover and express what it was that the prophets intended to say by their words. how their contemporaries understood them, perhaps misunderstood them, why people, and this is key, why they cherished the text, preserved it, very expensive stuff, got to shear a lamb and then get the skin off it and work on it. It was a real expert business and horribly expensive, not like having a photocopier to churn stuff out. So they had to do that, and they're not going to do it to everything. They're going to, and when it was handed on from father to son and mother to daughter and through, and then the next generation and the next, and we're still handing it on, well, human beings aren't that stupid. There's probably something quite valuable in it. So people cherished the text, preserved it, copied it, handed it on. Now this is key, as I'll show you in a moment. Commented on the text and edited the text. The danger is you could think that Jeremiah spoke, somebody copied down what he said, and it stuck, and there it is forever. It's not like that, as I'm going to hopefully demonstrate as best I can today. No, it's not like that. The text was alive, and God was thought to be judged to be speaking through it. So 2-4 generations later, when new circumstances arose, people thought, ah, that's what prayer, that's what God was trying to tell us then. So they changed the texts. They improved the text. They made it real. You know, like we write a catechism, hopefully, or we write a new liturgy, if only that was happening, and we try and update it, make it relevant and connect with people today. So that's what they were doing. The text is fluid because they're not fundamentalists and they're looking for God's word in it. Let's look at the word prophet, because this is a key insight too. The Greek word, which you get it from, prophetes, means one who speaks forth, proclaims. In itself, it's got nothing to do with talking about the future, though that could happen. So I am at the moment proclaiming, I'm speaking before you, physically, get it? So that's what a prophet would be doing. He'd be getting up and talking to the congregation publicly and saying, wait a minute, and speaking, proclaiming on behalf of God. So the prophets, when they saw themselves as part of a prophetic tradition, so as I hope we'd all be, they're not just starting a newfangled idea. They're being faithful to the past. And the beginnings of the prophetic movement are simply lost in the mists of history. We haven't got them. Abraham, for example, is called a prophet. And we're told that he stood before Yahweh. What a beautiful image. Stood before Yahweh as a prophet and spoke from his encounter with God. Hosea speaks of Moses as a prophet. And in the community there was an accepted trust that Yahweh would continue to raise up prophets like Moses. Deuteronomy says that. And they kept believing that God wouldn't leave them alone, but would keep sending somebody from somewhere to speak to us now. They've got their institutions, they've got the Torah, they've got their cult. But we need people today, 2011, to speak to us from a place of prayer, whoever that person might be. Samuel's a prophet. You know some of the stories about Elijah and Elisha, and I won't go into them now. A third introductory point is, and this might surprise you, if you're used to reading the Bible and you can't help hear bits of it at church at least, then I'll read you these, nothing to do with the Bible. They're from ancient times, from other places. And if you substitute for the God, Yahweh, instead, or the Lord, you could swear it came out of the Bible. So the idea of people speaking on behalf of the gods wasn't just an Israelite custom. It's all over the place, in Assyria and Babylonia and Egypt and everywhere. I'll read you these texts just to get a feel for them, to realise that these prophets in Israel were part of a movement all over the world. I lifted up my hands to Baal Shamayim, which means the God of the heavens. And Baal Shemaim answered me, and Baal Shemaim spoke to me through seers and messengers. And Baal Shemaim said to me, fear not, because it was I who made you king, and I shall stand with you, and I shall deliver you from all the kings who forced a siege upon you. Doesn't that sound like one of the prophets talking to a king of Israel? This is from 1800 BC or something. I, Ishtar, will go before you and behind you. Fear not. Straight out of Isaiah, you'd think. Similar. Fear not, Ashurbanipal, the king of Assyria. Now, as I have spoken, it will come to pass. I shall grant it to you. Over the people of the four languages and over the armament of the princes, you will exercise sovereignty. So someone's got up, spoken to the king, because the king wanted to hear it. He might have been looking for advancement. It's not all honest, this stuff. You don't know what's going on. But the words sound pretty biblical to me. And lastly, because I could go on forever, the kings of the countries confer together. Come, let us rise against Ishurbanipal. Ninlil answered, the kings of the lands I shall overthrow, place under the yoke, their feet in strong fetters. Fear not, as she that bears for her child, so I care for you. I've placed you like an amulet on my breast. Fear not, my son, whom I have raised. You okay with that? It's just a simple example to show you when you're reading the prophets, you're reading an Israelite phenomenon, but it's multiplied in the surrounding cultures. At times, the prophets looked to the past, of course, for they were conscious of belonging to a sacred tradition to which they were striving to be faithful, as we still are. At times, they referred to the future. And very often for us, because of our Oxford Dictionary definition, when I use the word prophet, you think someone who foretells the future. That's a problem, really, and we have to cut away from that. No, prophet is someone who speaks now to real people now. Oh, come on. So the future, when they speak of it, because sometimes they do, you do too, I do too, we do too, the people, the pundits in the newspapers are doing it. What's going to happen now that Osama bin Laden's been killed? Well, you better be careful because, and we project into the future probabilities and possibilities and we organise for it. It's normal behaviour. So the prophets did that too. But the future which their contemporaries were bringing on themselves, if you continue to do this, this is going to happen. If you continue to do this, that'll happen. And by the way, it might surprise you, but it shouldn't if you read carefully, half the time they were wrong. The prophets in the Bible got it wrong, but what they didn't get wrong was who God is and what mattered in people's lives. Sometimes their projections were actually didn't work out. Plenty of examples I could give you of that. So we're not, the key to prophecy isn't accuracy in looking into a crystal ball, thank you, and foreseeing the future. The key to prophecy is what's here. Sometimes they speak of the future in very general terms, but it's always poetic, and ultimately it's about God. The lamb will lie down with the lion, you know, and the child. It's saying, okay, this will happen and this will happen if you don't. Sometimes they're right or wrong in that. They're never wrong when they say, well, even if you don't do what you should do, even if we fail in this, even if we muck it all up and Jerusalem is destroyed because we did, God will be there and peace will come and God's will transcends all our behaviour and the future will be blessed by God. Here's my point. The key focus of the prophets isn't on the past and is not on the future, but it's on the present, their present. From their communion with God, they came to inspired insights into what was to be done or not done if the people were to be open to the grace that God is offering them. However, the prophets frequently back up their words with threats and promises. We're going to see plenty of it from now on. Sometimes they judge that things had gone so far as to be irreversible, Mostly, however, their predictions are conditional on how people respond. If you do it, it'll be fine, but if you don't, so it's up to people to behave accordingly. Whether they repented or went on behaving badly while ignoring the prophetic message. At first glance, the approach of the prophets, check all this for yourself as we go through, of course, I'm telling you the best I know, but you've got to check it. They seem very simple. God knows everything. This is a bit of a logical argument here. God can know the future, obviously, you'd think. So God can see what's going to happen in the future. So God comes along and tells a prophet. Why not? God can see it, so why can't he tell me or tell you? And then you can tell us. So it looks all a pretty logical thing. It doesn't work like that. The prophet is a seer. It's another word used for a prophet. And he's looking at, as we're all asked to do, looking at the world, to simplify it, at two dimensions. One is he's looking at the divine purpose, looking beyond the empirical data and events and human decisions and indecisions, and he's looking at the source of all things and discerning in prayer what God is doing, how God is acting in our lives and in our history and in our presence. And we're going to see a lot of that they got wrong. Of course they did, because they're human beings, for heaven's sake, and they had an idea of God. We're going to see it's critical, reading the Old Testament, to realise they didn't know Jesus. So how could they get it all right? How could they? Why couldn't they think that revenge was what God wanted before they met Jesus, who says, no, love your enemies. It's not the way. Well, that's no prophet. Prophets would have said to Jesus, for God's sake, this is hopeless, because they didn't understand. So don't presume everything you're going to read. Don't be disappointed if a lot of what you read doesn't sit with you in the light of your reflections on Jesus. It doesn't sit with me, and it shouldn't either. So they're looking at the divine purpose as best they can, and they do it very well. They just do it in a faulty way, like we all do. And they're looking at the level of human action of obedience and disobedience. Philosophically, a crucial thing needs to be said in relation to that, and I better be careful or I'll go on too much about this, or I'll say so little you don't know what I'm talking about. And I'm caught here a bit. God doesn't foresee the future. The language is wrong. To foresee, think of it, if you foresee what's going to happen tomorrow, you're here, tomorrow is in the future, and you foresee it. You see it before it happens. That's what we mean. There's no before with God. It doesn't work philosophically. There's no past. There's no memory. There's no plan. There's no. God simply is. And everything in the movement of time that we're struggling with and aware of, everything that's real is in the presence of God, who sees it, because it's there, it's real. So God doesn't foresee, God doesn't see things before they happen. It's before they happen from our point of view, but God sees them because they're real. Excuse me. With us, a lot of the time, we are projecting probabilities the best we can do into the future because we don't know what people are going to decide. Jesus in the agony in the garden can see possibilities emerging, but he doesn't know what Pilate's going to do. Pilate didn't know what he was going to do the night before. He doesn't know what the high priest is going to do. Excuse me, the high priest didn't know what he was going to do before he did it. Everything's possible. Could they have changed? Could Pilate have said, I've had enough of this and let it, stopped it? Of course he could have. Had he, everything would have been different, except Jesus would have still been the incredible lover and believer and truster and healer and forgiver and revealer that he is. So when we're thinking of God, you can't do anything else because your brain is hardwired to think in space and time. So's mine. There's nothing else we can do about that imaginative reconstruction except having reconstructed it, we've got to put a line through it and say, well, I can't think of any other way, but it's actually wrong. God is, God sees, God loves. Everything is in the present tense with God, because God's existence isn't got bit by bit in the flux of time the way mine and yours is. The future, by definition, is unpredictable. Predictions about their contemporaries' future, the prophets, as I've said, often got wrong. And then there are other predictions which are really just statements of faith in who God really is. Last bit before we'll take a small pause. There's a wide range of prophetic experiences. Don't think of prophetic experiences are all the same. Every single prophet would have had a different experience, just like every one of us in the room has different religious experiences, different loves in our life, different ways of accessing God, different things are important to you than to me, and we've got to respect each other's journey. And the church, if it's truly Catholic in that sense of universal, has to be such that we've got to check things, and we've got to say things are phony when they are phony in ourselves first and then in others. We've got to be critical, but we've got to be respectful of the wide range. So prophetic experience is a wide-ranging thing of which I have little understanding, but some. Look at some of the words they use. They call some of them a nabi, which means a prophet. Some of them a rohe in Hebrew, a seer. Some of them a hose, and hose is a beautiful word. It means someone who enlightens. They are sitting under the tree. They are enlightened themselves, and they are people who enlighten us. The light switches on. Some of them at times they're called an Ish Elohim, a man of God, connected with God. And there'd be other words too. When they're prophesying, what are they doing? First of all, they're being intelligent and reading the signs of the times. Amos will do next week, saw what was happening and spoke to it. Of course he did. He was an intelligent human being in touch with what was going on in his own environment. Sometimes they're looking for signs, and they vary a lot. Some of them we would probably think is a bit superstitious, but then I can be a bit superstitious probably, and you might be able to be too. I mean, there's a lot of superstition around. You can't be always highly intelligent about the way we think of religion. So superstition is part of the human makeup that we need to control, but it's there. And they'll be looking for signs, and they'll see signs in the world, in the sky, that are actually not from God at all, but they might link it. Dreams, visions, ecstasy, trance, as well as perceptive and critical judgment, both of the times and of the will of God, and many other factors were at play in the prophetic experience and in the way that this experience was conveyed. This is big. And discernment is always the hardest thing in your own life, in other people's lives. It's a big, big question. We've got to be so humble, really. So let's look at this. How do you discern a true from a false prophet? Well, you could read all your way through the Bible and you won't come up with anything at all satisfactory. They didn't know exactly. Right. Moses, there's a couple of criteria, though. Moses is presented as the exemplar of all true prophets. So in a way that today, you know, people, if the people's going to prophesy, in a way you'd probably check them against Jesus a bit. Like if they contradicted what Jesus said, I think you'd think, no, they've got it wrong, because of who Jesus is. Well, in the Jewish world, Moses, as presented, was the great prophet. So contradict Moses and you won't get far. To be accepted as authentic prophecy, oracles had to be uttered in the name of Yahweh, the name of the Lord, and be consistent with the inspired words and deeds of Moses. So there's a consistency in their thinking. Consistency also with approved prophecy. You won't see that at the beginning, because I'm going to start you next week with the earliest of the written prophets. But when you get down later, their words had to fit with Jeremiah or with Isaiah or with whoever it was 200 years ago. You can understand that. The quality of life of the one claiming to be a prophet is another criterion. It still is. If a person gets up and speaks for God, but they're not humble, they're not patient, they're not listening, they're dogmatic, well, please ignore what they're saying, because it's nothing. And they might fluke it and be right. I don't say you'd necessarily say they're wrong, but you'd be unwise to take much notice, wouldn't you? Because the criterion aren't there. Whereas if somebody gets up and speaks clearly, gently, humbly, and in touch with things a bit, and it makes sense to you, well, you're more likely to listen. Now, when prophecies are included, future prophecies, their authenticity could be guaranteed only when the predictions came true. That is so clear when it comes to Jeremiah, which we'll see in 4 or 5 weeks' time. Jeremiah, apparently, he wasn't the only one, but he was the main one who said, look, Jerusalem is going to be destroyed if you keep mucking around and siding with Egypt and fighting against Babylon, you're going to go under. Every other prophet in the district, because it's a movement too of prophets, they said, oh, no, God, other foreign God couldn't defeat our God. Do you get it? Jerusalem was saved in 701 miraculously by God. Jerusalem will never be destroyed. The temple will always be there. And Jeremiah says it won't always be there unless you change your behaviour. They didn't listen. When the temple was destroyed and people went into exile, can you see what they're doing? They're looking back and saying, all those other prophets, those people who claimed to be speaking from God, got it wrong. Jeremiah got it right. We better look a bit closer at what Jeremiah was telling us. So the book becomes a very critical centre of their psyche. Now I'll give you some readings, which are all very embarrassing because I don't want to be too self-conscious, but because priests are always talking about God, I'm doing a bit of it now, aren't I? We run a high risk of failing in all of these. So if I start blushing, will you forgive me? Yeah. These are statements from various prophets. I won't give you who they're from now, because they're all written there for you. Listen to the... This is the God speaking through the prophet. Listen to the words I say. Open your mouth and eat what I am about to give you, then go and speak. That's Ezekiel. Listen first, take it in, absorb it, get the message, then go and speak. And don't go hearing off speaking before you've done that. The priests, says Jeremiah, teach whatever they please, and the people love it. Thank God that's changed. Yes. Oh, Sharon Begara now, David. What do you think? Here's Jeremiah. Prophet no less than priest, all practice fraud. Gee, we're going through hard times now, but I don't know that you'd say, that's a big thing to say. We survived those times, by the way. Faith isn't dependent on everyone else being virtuous. You can be the only saint in the world and faith will continue through you. So don't excuse, we shouldn't excuse ourselves by saying, if only the Pope, or if only the Bishop, or if only the priest, or if only something, if only they would do something about it. If Jesus had said that, what's the point? So, back to the Jeremiah, not me. Prophet, now, they dress my people's wounds without concern. Peace, peace, they say, but there's no peace. Isn't that powerful stuff? It's out of context as I'm giving it to you now, but I wonder, this is about discerning. Here's Jeremiah saying, listen to all that stuff you're hearing, it's wrong. Try me again. This is dear Jeremiah again. You've seduced me, Yahweh. Jeremiah got sucked into being a prophet. But everything he had to say, because of the times he lived in, they were tough times, he had to say things nobody wanted to hear. So every time he did it, he got into trouble. And God, and they tried to kill him and a whole lot of other things. So he says to God, look, leave me alone. I didn't ask to be a prophet. Get off me back. You've seduced me and I let myself be seduced. You've overpowered me and you were the stronger. I'm a laughingstock. I'm everybody's butt. The word of Yahweh has meant for me insult, derision all day long, says Jeremiah. I used to say, all right, I won't think about him. I won't speak in his name anymore. I'm going home and I'm going to do a Sudoku and get all that stuff out of my mind. Because it does fill in your time. I find every now and then I do it. They're very quite hard. Then, this is Jeremiah, I'm not going to do it anymore. Then there seemed to be a fire burning in my heart, imprisoned in my bones. The effort to restrain it wearied me. I couldn't bear it. So he blurted out the next bit and got into a bit more trouble. Oh, Lord, this is close to the bone, isn't it? But I'm trying to give you the idea that not all prophets are going to be. Don't listen to what the prophets say. They're deluding you. This is still Jeremiah talking. They retail visions of their own, not what comes from the mouth of Yahweh. Again, I have not sent them, says God, but they're running. I haven't spoken to them, but they're prophesying. And again, let the prophet who has a dream tell the dream as his own. Nothing wrong with that. I had a dream. Good. But don't say it's God. Do you get it? Let him who receives a word from me, from God, deliver it accurately. Doesn't my word burn like a fire? Is it not like a hammer shattering the rock? The rabbis, beginning of our era, used to love this text because unlike us, I'll rephrase that, but our attempt, my attempt, scholarly attempt, is to try and find the meaning of a word. And it's a good thing, a very good thing. What was he saying? What exactly was the point he was making? It's an ambitious, scientific, and very good thing to do. The rabbis weren't into that. They said, if it's God's word, it's got 1,000 meanings. They get a big hammer and belt onto it, and all these flashes of light would come out. And the more, the better. It's a different mentality. They're looking for the divine in it all, and they're excited by all the possible meanings that a word could have. And that's one reason why I'm going back, I'll say later, why the scrolls kept alive. Because they kept digging into them and writing into the text itself, which we wouldn't like to do. We'd put in a footnote. But they put it in the text, reorganizing the text, renewing it, revisualizing it, etc. I never sent them or commissioned them. They serve no good purpose for this people. It's like a joke years ago when they first used to, priests got these things on the altar back in Randwick. Not a joke, but anyhow. An old priest there had the first time he'd had all this, books, and after Vatican II, probably a microphone. And he looked into the thing and he started, and as he said, there's something wrong with this. And the people said, and also with you. but they didn't mean it to be rude. They were just giving the answer to what he should have been saying, the Lord be with you. But what he actually said was, there's something wrong with this, and they said, and also with you. I reckon the church had the decency to crack up anyhow. Okay, a little bit more of this. No, it happened. Yep. Here's another thing. I'm not giving you too much. I'm giving you a lot of this at the beginning so that you're wary when you're reading the prophets. Wary, careful, discerning. The priests have never asked, where is Yahweh? They're doing what they're supposed to do. It says Jeremiah, he's talking about his day, but of course it can still be relevant. We've got to, but he's saying, look, they're not asking, where is Yahweh? They're just repeating the whatever. My people have abandoned me, the fountain of living water, only to dig cisterns for themselves, cisterns that hold no water. Every second year, a new Christian community emerges from somewhere, God knows where, somewhere in New Zealand or Kipax or and somebody starts off and they have a little group and the little group gather around them and they leave the great big oak tree that's borne saints, fruits, theology, philosophy for 2,000 years and they join another. It's too sad, really. I mean, it's hard belonging to the church, don't you find? I mean, you may not, but I do anyhow. Of course it's hard, but I find it not that easy living with me either, I have to tell you. So life's a big thing, but you're not going to leave something that's produced millions of saints for a chance on a new horse that's galloped out of New Zealand in the name of Jesus. The shepherds are the ones who've been stupid. They haven't searched for Yahweh. You shepherds have let my flock be scattered and go wandering and you haven't taken any care of them. And then there's a whole text there. The leader is like a sentry. His function is to keep watch and to warn of approaching danger. And in case you've had nearly enough, this is Ezekiel. It's a beautiful image. Say to those who make up prophecies out of their own heads, the Lord Yahweh says this: woe to the foolish prophets who follow their own spirit without seeing anything. Like jackals in a ruin, so are your prophets, Israel. They've never ventured into the breach. They've never bothered to fortify the house of Israel or stand fast in battle. They've empty visions and give lying prophecies and they say it's Yahweh who speaks, though Yahweh hasn't sent them. Instead of my people rebuilding the wall, these men come and slap on plaster. Cover up the cracks. Don't be too hard on leaders, priests and prophets, because this all applies to me and you, doesn't it? Parents, everybody's got public servants. I mean, this is for everybody to listen to. The priests have violated my laws and desecrated my sanctuaries. They've drawn no distinction between the sacred and the profane. And finally, I'll give Ezekiel the last word. Trouble for the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Shepherds ought to feed their flock. Yet you have fed on milk. You've dressed yourselves in wool. You've sacrificed the fattest sheep but failed to feed the flock. You failed to make weak sheep strong or to care for the sick ones or bandage the wounded ones. You failed to bring back strays or look after the lost. My flock has been scattered all over the country. No one bothers about them and no one goes looking for them. You've had enough of that? Two more things, then I'll take a proper break. There are prophecies in the texts you'll find. Some of them are called curses. They're prophecies of curses, a bit of an English word that's hard to fit in here, but they're prophecies of warning. And they're primarily faith statements reminding the listeners of who God is, of the fact that God's judgments are just, you can't pull the wool over God's eyes, and of God's anger, which is the word they use. And by anger they mean a passionate concern for repentance and determination to set right what is wrong. That God isn't up there saying, well, I don't care how the world goes, let's fine. God is passionately concerned for you and me and us and our institution and everything, and he's inspiring everybody to do something about it, and we can't put the blame over there. We've got to do our bit to get it going. And prophecies of warning are warning people, if you don't, this is going to happen. On the human historical plane, these prophecies of warning, and you're going to get stacks of them, functioned as warnings to bring about repentance. So people would change, realizing how stupid their behavior was, lest evil bear its rotten fruit. in Denmark or wherever. Prophecies of blessing were also primarily statements of faith. They reminded people of God's transcendent, loving providence. In addition, they were hope statements, encouraging fidelity and obedience so as to establish the conditions in which God's will could be realized and God's blessing bestowed. God isn't running the world. We'll come back to this in a minute. God isn't doing things. If God's going to do something, he's going to do it through you, so you better listen. And the saints are those who really listened. And look, Mother Mary MacKillop's not a bad way to start, is it, for us Australians? And think of what that woman did in her life because she listened. And the fruit is all around us. So wonderful things happened. One, the power of one. Well, everyone in this room is quite capable of being an instrument of God's immense, courageous love. We're not doing everything. We have to be blessed by God to do it, but we have to be open to it. And the prophets are telling us to be open. And I'll finish with a statement by Eichrod on his commentary on Ezekiel, and then we'll take a pause. The predictions of prophets are always associated with that to which the prophets testify. A direct awareness of the whole control of providence. So they subordinate each single historical event to its context in the activity of God, which makes the whole development of history serve God's kingdom. Their limitation, and we'll be starting on them next week, consists in the fact that they're trying to show the way along which God is leading. Whereas God is always transcendent, far above any human capabilities, and so God's march through history cannot be imprisoned in human words. Part of the problem may be among some Islamists with the Quran. It's like God's locked into an 8th century document, so you can't do anything about it. Or a fundamentalist Christian who reads the words of Paul in Corinthians about marriage, which was a different institution to the one we know, and applies them today. Do you see what's happening? As though it's all locked in these words. The Jews were never like that. Not historically. There were Jewish fundamentalists too. They saw the word as living and they kept it alive and they re-envisaged it, as we'll see. So, God carries his plans home and attains his objective with all the freedom of the Creator. So while prediction can make statements clarifying the plan and assuring us of its existence, it can never determine the exact line it will take or calculate beforehand its individual stages. So prediction demands humble obedience to the mystery of the divine work of realization, and like the rest of what prophets preach, it confronts the hearer with the question of a faith which refuses to let itself be led astray by unexpected delays, changes of front, or reconstruction. I'm not sure how happy I read that. When Germans write German and someone translates them, it's hard work, isn't it? Unless you're a really good translator.